Shrink Wrap Radio number 38, June 10th, 2006, and Artist's Journey of Transformation.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I think what we have to do is give ourselves to our own immediate process. And inevitably, and here's where we all come together in our humility, inevitably, we will have to walk into something that looks and feels like the death of our idea of ourselves. You know, and so to think it's not, you know, to think we can avoid it, I think is folly. So, you know, I mean, the simple advice has most to do with trusting our own lives exactly where they are completely.
That was the voice of artist Jerry Winstrom. In 1979, when he was 29 years old, Jerry Winstrom was an artist living in New York City, and he'd already produced a large body of work. At that point in his life, he felt an overwhelming spiritual urging to discover the rock-bottom truth of his life. For years, he questioned the limits of his creative life as a studio painter. In his quest, he ended up destroying all of his art and giving away everything he owned. In an extraordinary leap of faith, Jerry began a life of unconditional trust, allowing life to provide all that was needed. He lived this way for 15 years. In 1998, he moved to Washington State, where he lives now, and there he eventually married Marilyn Strong and produced a large new body of work. Now Marilyn and Jerry's charming Whidbey Island home on Puget Sound is filled with his unique interactive sculptures and paintings. Jerry also built a 40-foot meditation tower on his property. His art and this tower can both be seen in the Parabola magazine documentary film called In the Hands of Alchemy, The Art and Life of Jerry Winstrom. And Jerry's story is told in his book, The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation, which has a foreword by Thomas More. You'll find links to both the film and the book in our show notes. After viewing the film and reading his book, I was eager to engage with Jerry. Here's our conversation. My guest today is artist, author, and workshop leader, Jerry Winstrom. Jerry, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
Jerry, I've been reading your book, The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation. And it's really quite a story. It's an extraordinary and moving account of your taking a certain kind of leap of faith and what happened after that. Before we get into the leap you took back in 1979, in whatever way feels spontaneous and real for you now, I'm wondering if you can set the stage for us by telling us what your life was like before you took that leap.
Well, I was very driven as an artist. I mean, I often say about that time, if I could have painted my way to heaven, I would have done it because I tried hard enough. And I think art, you know, like Ramakrishna says, when you take a boat across the river, you don't You don't drag it over the land once you get to the other side. I think in many ways, art was my boat. You know, it was my psychological process. It was sort of my, you know, everything I could do with my will and good intentions and everything I had available as a human being. And at some level, getting to the place, you know, as Yogananda says, to set out on any holy purpose and to die along the way is to succeed. I think I took art to the place where I couldn't give it one more ounce of anything and survive. I mean, I created a huge body of work. It was my false god. And it delivered as much as it possibly could as a form in my life. And so at the point where I realized something was shifting, I fasted for a month, and I just gave myself to whatever might come. And after fasting, it became very clear to me that I could keep doing what I was doing, but it felt like a fear-based choice into something that was safe. Or I could follow this intuitive allurement that I sensed would give me everything I was looking for, but it promised nothing in any sort of external way. And so on the strength of that intuitive sense of something greater, I destroyed the work and I gave everything I owned away, and I lived that way for the next 15 years, simply trusting life to carry me as it would.
Yeah, wow, that was really quite a step to take. Now, at the point that you gave everything away, I mean, let's just establish, were you in fact enjoying some sort of success as a New York artist at that point?
Well, you know, I think I was certainly known for what I did. But, you know, my work was dark. I painted into my fears. I did, you know, for example, series on suicide and the Holocaust, and I painted into the things that frightened me, and in the process found liberation. I mean, I would see in some way, I would find the sacred in all of it, and that would liberate me. And at some, you know, and I also trusted that perhaps it would do that for other people. But the simple fact is the paintings were often dark, you know, and I don't think they were the kind of things people would want to necessarily hang in their living room on the couch. So at that level of success, I don't think that I was, you know, selling paintings at the local gallery. Okay. But I was certainly showing, and I was, and you know, I was known as an artist, and there was a film being made about my art at the time I did all this.
Yes. As it sounds like you had a kind of spiritual trajectory even before you took this leap. Are you able to point to a specific, I mean, has that always been in your life, or was there a turning point for you when you began to develop this spiritual interest?
Well, I think spirituality is inseparable from creativity, and I think any artist, and it's not necessarily spiritual in relation to religion, but I think there's a certain understanding that comes with a creative, with creativity itself. And certainly the studio being something of a laboratory, I got it that, you know, and you know, having produced that large body work, I mean, I got it that I could, if, you know, when I brought a painting to the level that was kind of status quo with everything I knew and could do up to that point, and could take a risk and maybe ruin what I had done, that's the place inspiration came through. And that is a sort of epiphany, or it's a sort of spiritual moment, you might say, like a quantum leap, where you leave everything you know, mm-hmm. and something larger takes over. And I always saw that as a kind of spiritual event, and I courted it in a very sort of sacred way, and called on it and invoked it to the best of my ability. But, you know, I think it was like the moment, and I got very good at that, you know. And so I think the moment I said, well, what a good boy am I can do this, the God says, okay, now do it with your whole life. So I was ready for the leap, you might say, but it still scared the hell out of me.
Oh, it's...
You know, it was at one level completely terrifying, because it was the loss of an identity and everything I thought was most me. And at the other level, I intuited something so incredibly beautiful that would come with that level of trust. And it proved to be the most important thing I've ever done with my life.
Yeah. And, you know, I think probably one of the reasons why I resonate so much with your book and why other people have and why you've been invited for interviews like this and to speak in a variety of settings is I think many of us must resonate to some of those same themes, even though we haven't had the courage to do quite what you did. But I remember as a younger person often feeling the impulse to drop out of school, to jump on a motorcycle, to completely abandon my life as I had known it, and just sing folk songs to children as I rode around the country. And in a sense, you took a step like that, just really abandoning everything that everybody expected of you and that you had expected of yourself, and you took that leap.
Yes, you know, and I think the journey is different for each of us. I mean, however much we can trust in the mystery, you know, I think that's as much as our uniqueness will emerge from the experience. You know, I mean, as long as we keep looking for some kind of reference point in the world, it's always going, our reality will never be completely our own as a kind of unique expression as our birthright. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think however much we're able to do that is as much of our true self will be allowed to emerge. And so we all do what we can.
Yeah. Thomas More wrote a nice introduction to your book, and I think he made reference to the wise fool. And I've been doing some workshops myself on the hero's journey and often call on the tarot as part of the work that I do. And I don't know whether it was Thomas More's reference in the book, or I think this would have come to me on my own, is that the first card, or the zero card in the Rider-Waite deck, which is known as the Fool, and it depicts a fool in what do they call that form of dress, fool's cap, the harlequin costume that we all more or less recognize as that of the fool. And it depicts this guy who appears to be stepping off a cliff, and there's a dog with him, and his dog is barking at his heels, and it's ambiguous whether the dog is warning him or is about to follow him, and it's ambiguous whether or not the fool is stepping off the cliff to his death, to be dashed on rocks below, or whether the fool is in touch with something else, that he knows that there's some kind of divine support for this journey that he's about to take. And I have to say, reading your book, I've never seen a clearer embodiment of everything that seems to be implied by that card.
Yes, and you know, and maybe the dog is his instinctual messenger, mm-hmm. sort of encouraging him on as well. You know, that's that sort of intuitive allurement. You know, I also think, you know, the fool in, you know, I think of the fool in the tarot deck as also, there's the element of the naive. You know, it's like there's a saying that, you know, children and innocence is divinely protected.
Yes.
And I think at the point where I made that leap, you know, it was, there was some level of consciousness as to what I was giving myself to. So I, you know, I can't claim complete naivete at that level, mm-hmm. you know, which I think the fool represents. That kind of, I mean, I think I knew enough about the template of surrender and the possibilities of inspiration coming in some larger way that was beyond my effort, that I really had a sense that that's what I was giving myself to. I mean, the terror was I could be wrong. I could be insane. I mean, this could be like the, you know, the craziest thing I could possibly
right.
be doing. So it was a mixed bag. You know, Yogananda says something pretty outrageous that I think, you know, a lot of people might even be offended by. But he said, you know, he tells the Christ story, and he says that the Christ, he says he feels the Christ never would have walked into the crucifixion if he didn't know he was going to be saved. And I think as we get older and we become, you know, more conscious, hopefully, I think we get a sense of that, of some kind of resurrection or some kind of happily ever after. We all believe in that possibility in our bones. You know, you talk about resonate. I think that's what resonates true with all of us, is we expect at some deep level for everything to turn out well if we can only trust enough. So there's a mix there.
Yeah. What you just said evoked for me the image of flying in my dreams. The way that flying manifests for me in my dreams, at least a lot in the past, is if I can somehow achieve the right attitude in the dream space and gently lay myself upon the air, it will support me. And then again, if I can just hold the right attitude, I start to rise up. And so it's really more of a floating than a flying, but it's very much an act of faith. And what you just described somehow triggered that for me.
Yes, and I think we also have to embrace our humanity and the inherent nature of defeat as well. You know, so there's something that the soul knows, and the soul, you know, wants to be carried by that larger force. And at the same time, I think, and here's where the terror comes in for all of us, the ego knows it must be defeated. So there are also the deaths that really look and feel everything like death. So you can't have one without the other. You know, I mean, it's almost like one empowers the other. It's almost like when you can walk into everything that looks like death and you see no possibility of survival, I think that's the place where that kind of carrying, where we are able to be carried by those larger forces. So, you know, they're both right there. If it was all just love and light, I think we'd all do it quite easily, but it really also looks like death, and that's the reality of it, but that's also the power of it.
And that comes through in your book. I mean, there are places in your book. Your book is, for listeners, the book is written very simply and clearly, wisely, as a series of short vignettes, just describing little scenes in this whole process after you had destroyed your art, after you had more or less taken a vow of silence, or at least experienced long periods of silence, after you made the decision to just kind of trust the universe to provide you with food and you went through periods of hunger. I forgot where I was going with this. Help me.
You were talking about the book. I mean, the book was written, I think we all, you know, beyond our strategy and our, you know, our conscious attempt at achievement, I think we all have a personal mythology that is unfolding. And however much we can sort of meet the conditions of our own uniqueness halfway, that is what adds to the, you know, the truth and the solidity of our mythology. So I tried to write the book in a way that were about those moments of transformation where it's like all was lost and I don't know how I'm going to survive this moment.
Right.
And that mystery came through and carried me beyond what I could even imagine.
Yeah, and
so the book is a series of those events.
Mm-hmm. And that the point that I lost, I think, was related to terror. And some of the events that you described certainly trigger my terror points because I grew up in a kind of ghetto-like area and had accounts such as the ones that you described where you were surrounded by a group of young black youths in New York City several times where it looked like, okay, this could be a place where you get mugged, where you get beat up, where they take advantage of you. And you were certainly conscious of that. But you made the choice to be naive and to be vulnerable, to be loving and to be simple. And miraculously, you didn't get beat up. and it turned out well. It turned out to be a moment of real contact and communication. It takes real courage, I think, to do that in the moment. I've been in situations where I can remember being in a situation with a friend who had something of that naive quality, and we were in a bar, and somebody said something aggressive, and right away I could feel my back get up. And I'm not a big guy, but I have the instincts of a big guy, and my back gets up, you know, and I start to feel that aggressive energy. And my friend just kind of smiled and said something simple and sweet, and it it totally turned the situation.
Yes, I mean, I think part of, you know, I wouldn't have chosen most of the situations I was right about, but I think part of that initial leap was saying yes to everything unconditionally without interference, you know. I mean, my personal mantra at that time, and still is, you know, there's either a God of everything or there's a God of nothing. So if the God doesn't carry you over those moments that are unavoidable, and you can't trust completely something at the heart of it that will make everything come more alive, then don't give yourself to any of it and just live in fear and make life very safe for yourself with enough money and enough security and enough of the things that are most reasonable. So I think making that choice opened the door to everything. Anything that came was it.
But there must be a voice that comes in your head that says, but people do die. People do get beat up. People do starve to death in New York City. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think fear is every bit as creative as trust and courage, you know? And I think all I know is everything that I try to avoid ultimately broadsized me. In other words, the things that I have feared in my life that I wanted to avoid were the very things that came unexpectedly for me to deal with over and over again.
Yes.
I think, you know, for those of us who lose our lives or we end up hungry on the streets or even die, I think in many ways that's part of our creation and part of what it is we've signed up for this time around, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know any more than that. And all I know is in my own case, my fear would create the very thing that I was trying to hold at bay. And so I assume it's the same for the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And I think in a larger sense, because you also have babies dying in horrible circumstances, I think you have to embrace the possibility that we've all signed up for exactly the life that we need to this time around. And you have to open up to the possibility that maybe we come around over and over again. And there's no other explanation for it. I mean, that is what I've read from, you know, many of the mystics. And it's also my sense of things. And without it, you know, there's really no explanation. And it's always a paradox. It's always a mystery. And it doesn't mean that we just have to chalk it all up to, you know, that's their karma and we're not going to do anything to help other people. But I think if you don't have a sense of the perfection of the universe, then you're going to be dragged in to the same hole that you're trying to help other people get out of and help ourselves get out of. You have to trust it all and at the same time meet every moment halfway and do everything in your power to make life more beautiful for yourself mm-hmm. and for everyone around you.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly you've done that. I should mention, too, your film, and I'll put a link to your book and to the film, but the film certainly shows how you've spun off a lot of beauty in your own environment and shared it with the people who are around you. I think one of the reasons your story speaks so deeply to me personally is I grew up part-time with my grandmother, who was an evangelist, held tent meetings around the country, and was one of the first kind of women evangelists on a large scale. And she talked about how Jesus had appeared to her on a couple of occasions and pretty much given her the commandment to quit her banking career and just devote her life to him, which she did. And she would tell me stories of, and this happened during the Great Depression of the 30s here in the U.S., and she talked about times when, you know, she had done this, she had given up her lucrative career, she had a small child, my mother, they had no food, no money, and she prayed to God saying, you know, God, why have you led me down this path and have you forsaken me? And then she stepped outside her door and there was $5 lying on the ground that she didn't know where it had come from, and they were at their wit's end, and that $5 kind of saved them. And she had lots of stories like that, and I've found almost the identical story in your book.
Yes. Well, and there is the holy defeat that I talked about earlier, that you defeated the ego. It's at the place where you say, where you really do need your God, and you can't sort of fake that moment. I mean, it's a very real moment. And I think that's the template of death and resurrection, or death and renewal, is to befriend that moment, the moment where you feel all is lost, and know that that's where the magic happens. Yeah, and the story you mentioned, I'll tell briefly if you like. It's,
yes.
You know, it was a place, it was a time when I had fasted several days, and I was just out of energy, and I was feeling, you know, defeated, and like, what am I doing with this crazy life I have given myself to? And I was walking down the road, and I walked by a funeral parlor where there was a funeral going on, and looked in and saw, you know, sort of saw what was going on there. And I sort of, to myself, I said, I had the thought, you know, it's like in many ways, you know, this metaphoric death I had given myself to was only metaphoric, and I was still here physically. And I thought, how much easier it would have been to die physically if that's what I have to do to you know, to find this place of renewal. But here I am hungry. And so my question and my prayer at the moment was, So God, how am I going to take care of myself? How am I going to eat? And the moment I said that, it had rained, and the water was running down the gutter. A $20 bill floated by at the very moment I asked the question.
Wow. That's just perfect. And you know, and it's just so right. It's just so right. I just believe it. And I've had my own sort of minor experiences along those lines to definitely believe it. And a lot of us know the stuff at a head level of, you know, death and rebirth and so on. But to actually put it to the test in the way that you did, I mean, some of your friends must have thought you were crazy. Did they?
Well, I had every possible reaction. In fact, you know, one of the first people to call, in fact, the first person to call was Jean Houston. I don't know if you know who she is. She's very...
I do.
Very,
yeah, go ahead.
Her and her husband were working with artists. They had something of a laboratory, and, you know, and she knew I'd been fasting. She had heard I destroyed all my art. She was the first to call. I mean, even some of the people I, you know, expected the most to understand, you know, kind of didn't. And who, you know, I wouldn't have myself, so I don't blame anybody. I'm just saying there's a kind of loneliness that we have to take on if we're going to find our own true way. And, you know, again, there's no reference point. If there was a reference point, it wouldn't be your own unique relationship with the mystery.
Did you yourself ever wonder if you were psychotic?
I think I never wondered if I was psychotic. I certainly had doubts, and I still do, because in many ways, with everything going my way, I still have doubts. You know, so I think doubt comes with the territory. It's like your grandmother who said, you know, where do I go from here? And, you know, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe it's all, maybe I've been all wrong because the mystery has left town here. So I think, you know, I've had every imaginable doubt. But what I wanted to say is that the thing that carried life, and the hardest thing, which I wrote about in my book, if you recall, for me to deal with was that projection from other people, because I looked everything like that which no one wanted to be. I looked like nothing. I gave everything away. I owned nothing. I had nothing. I was nothing. And that's the big thing that we buffer ourselves against. You know, we get PhDs, you know, we get pretty cars and pretty wives and great houses, and we do all the things to make us into something. So here I was at the opposite end, and dealing with the projected fears of other people was a huge one for me. But I feel even that was in many ways carried by the same grace, because, like, you know, and I could tell a story of how my wife and I got together. And I was also celibate for 12 years, and moving to Whidbey, I, you know, ultimately got married. But this story is a very good example of how the projection works. I mean, how it gets dealt with. When I met Marilyn, I was just coming out of this life of, you know, coming back to the world in a sense. And Marilyn and I were friends for several years, and we were getting close, and I was opening up to the possibility of a relationship. And there was a Christmas party at her family, and so the whole family arrived. And Marilyn had been through a really painful divorce, painful because her husband left and she was completely devastated. I mean, it was her metaphoric death. And so in the midst of this party, people were they had heard bits and pieces about my story, and they thought, who is this strange guy with Marilyn? That's the last thing she needs, is some weirdo.
Yeah.
And everyone was thinking it, but, like good people, everyone's being very polite.
Uh-huh.
And there was one cousin who had a little bit too much to drink, and he just kind of pounced on me. And, basically saying, who are you and what are you doing here? And so, because I was nothing, because I have nothing, that question is a very good question. So the question becomes, instead of I'm all these wonderful things, I'm an artist or I'm a this or that, the question becomes, who am I, God? And that's the question I ask, who am I, God?
Mm-hmm.
And so what came, I simply told this, and when this man asked the question, everyone in the room froze and everyone was listening because everyone wanted to know it. He happened to be crazy enough at the moment to ask. And so the answer that came, I simply told him my story, a simple little version of my story. And he ended up in tears. He was an ex-hippie, you might say, who gave up on the possibility of that ideal mm-hmm. that came out of that time.
Mm-hmm.
He joined the military. He was an alcoholic. He sort of lost something essential in his life and his trust and his faith and his hope. And it completely won him over. And it also, at that moment, completely won the family over. So it wasn't about coming up with a good defense. It was about inhabiting the emptiness and letting the emptiness speak for itself that ultimately turns that projection around.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Was your, you mentioned sort of coming back into the world. Was that a gradual process or was there a distinct turning point where you decided, okay, I've done this, now I'm going to come back to the world?
The moment I said I could do this, I could live this life, it was the moment I felt like I was being drawn back into the world. And so returning to the world was the new challenge. That was the new thing that terrified me, opening up to relationship, opening up. I was sort of brought into speaking publicly and doing all the things that I had abandoned so many years ago. So it was an absolute reversal. Yes, and it was also, I think of it like the tide. The tide, it's a long period where the tide goes out. And the moment it's all the way out, there's a stillness, and you literally don't know if you're coming or going. And that's the place I was at when I felt the tide starting to come back again, and I knew I had to stay with the direction of the current
mm-hmm.
in order to, to stay in a sense on top of it and to stay with what was. So the return to the world was like that. It wasn't like overnight and all of a sudden I'm back in the world. It was the same way the world left, the same is the way the world returned.
Mm-hmm. And you seem like a person who in some ways is deeply introverted, and at the same time your present life seems to have you very much in the world, traveling all around, giving lectures, interviews, writing books. How is it for you, those balancing those two places in yourself?
Well, I think there's a kind of balance that happened. I also think of introvert and extrovert also as masculine, feminine, but not men, women. It's more like our natural masculine, feminine quality. So I think there was certainly a period where that balance found its way. I mean, I think as a young painter, I was probably more extroverted, and opening up to the inner life. And, more of the feminine life, which I think we're all required to do at this time. That was more where, it was like learning that aspect of my being. But I think one without the other, it's like juggling pins. If we're only good at catching one pin, then the other will always fall to the floor. And we can't just simply hold on to one way of being. And I think, if you look at like our current administration, I think it's an administration that has, is holding on to the masculine to the point of being destructive. I mean, the reasonable, it's all come down to, power and money and the things that reason bring and not the mystery and not the inner life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, this time more than ever, it's a requirement of both men and women to find that balance, And I think even the whole thing with the whole goddess, the reemergence of the interest in the goddess traditions, I think that, too, speaks of the need for that balance.
Okay, yes. I notice, on your website, you've got a very full lecture circuit and workshop schedule, and that a number of your presentations have been for Jungian societies, and we've talked a lot about Jungian thought on this show. What's the tie-in between your own work and the Jungian perspective?
Well, I just think I love working with the Jungians. We worked with Helen Luke's Apple Farm in Three Rivers, and we've done a lot, locally and in Canada. But I love working with the Jungians because they explore the depths more. So the mm-hmm. questions that come, there's a certain understanding. And the whole, the kind of new interest that has emerged around alchemy and the alchemical process, I think that's a big part of the Jungians' interest in, mm-hmm. in our work. So, but personally, I think, the template of death and renewal, which is in all spiritual traditions and is certainly essential in the alchemical tradition, is really understood and really pursued by the Jungians. And I think that's their interest. And I think, I don't feel like I'm a Jungian, but I think at some level, I've been, some of what it is I've given myself to has been claimed by the Jungians in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, other than that, I don't know what the link is. the template is understood, and it's the same.
Yes, yes. And I think anybody who's at all familiar with Jung and who takes the time to read your book, that they will see that. Most of us are, to kind of begin to wrap things up here, most of us will not have the motivation to go on the journey you've gone on, giving away everything that's most valuable to us, becoming celibate, taking a vow of silence, and so on. What is it that the rest of us can learn from your journey?
Well, I think the biggest thing to learn is that we're all in the best seat in the house, and my journey was my journey, and no one has to do it the way I did it. And in fact, if they did, it would be pretty silly. I think what we have to do is give ourselves to our own immediate process. And inevitably, and here's where we all come together in our humility, inevitably we will have to walk into something that looks and feels like the death of our idea of ourselves. And so to think it's not, to think we can avoid it, I think is folly. So, the simple advice has most to do with trusting our own lives exactly where they are completely.
Jerry Winstrom, thank you so much for being our guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. I've really enjoyed this dialogue with you.
Thank you very much, David, and thank you to your audience.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Jerry Winstrom. I was so touched by the depth and immediacy of his writing that I really hope to have as genuine an encounter as possible. In earlier episodes, I've touched upon the idea that sometimes our lives may be an expression of an archetype. As I mentioned in the interview, it's impossible to read Jerry's account without the archetype of the wise fool coming to mind. In particular, Jerry's story conjures up for me the tarot card known as the fool. There is a wonderful book on the tarot by Sally Nichols titled Jung and Tarot, An Archetypal Journey. She has a whole chapter on the fool. Let me read you an excerpt from that chapter. The fool is in such close contact with his instinctual side that he does not need to look where he is going in the literal sense. His animal nature guides his steps. In some tarot cards, the fool is pictured as blindfolded, further emphasizing his ability to act by insight rather than eyesight, using intuitive wisdom instead of conventional logic. Like the foolhardy third brother in fairy tales, who rushes in where angels fear to tread, and by doing so wins the hand of the princess and her kingdom. The fool's spontaneous approach to life combines wisdom, madness, and folly. When he mixes these ingredients in the right proportions, the results are miraculous. Our inner fool urges us on to life, where the thinking mind might be overcautious. What seems like a precipice from afar may prove to be only a small gully when approached with the fool's gusto. His energy sweeps everything before him, carrying others along like leaves in a fresh wind. Without the fool's energy, all of us would be mere pasteboard. Another of my favorite books on Tarot is titled Tarot and the Journey of the Hero. And let me read you from the first page of the chapter on the Fool. The author writes, "Isn't it strange that of all people, the fool should be the hero who succeeds in the great journey? Today we understand heroes to be completely different characters. They are courageous, strong, unwavering, clever, and always surrounded by the aura of the eternal winner. However, if we go back in history, we can see that all these courageous, invincible heroes come from a relatively recent era, even if some of them, like Gilgamesh, Hercules, Orion, or Perseus, can even look back on a history of 3,000 or 4,000 years. This distinctly masculine type of hero is a characterization from the early dawn of patriarchy and is substantially different from his older role models with which we are just as familiar. They have continued to live in the oral traditions, in our fairy tales and legends. There, at least at the beginning, the hero is never particularly courageous, strong, gallant, or skillful. Far from it, he is always the youngest, the idiot, the fool. But interestingly enough, it is precisely this simpleton who succeeds in accomplishing the great work. These stories all have the same basic pattern. For example, they tell of how a shadow falls over a blossoming kingdom, and the king lets a hero be sought who is willing to risk his life to save the land from threatening ruin. The king usually has 3 sons, and the 2 older sons immediately say they are willing to solve the problem. They are more or less sincere, yet they constantly attempt to complete the tests without success. When the youngest son prepares to try as well, everyone laughs at him and considers him lost. He knows that he isn't particularly smart, courageous, or skillful, but he takes the risk and sets off on his way, and after many trials and wondrous occurrences, he finds the treasure that is so hard to find, brings it home, and can therefore free the land from the great danger." The author also points out there are naturally many female equivalents for the story, in which the youngest daughter, in contrast to her frequently evil siblings, is the heroine, for example, Cinderella, Psyche, or King Lear's youngest daughter. The king would have believed anyone else capable of this deed, most of all his oldest sons, who very much resemble him and are almost as clever and brave as he is, or was once, but certainly he doesn't believe that his youngest son is going to be the hero. From these passages that I've just read, we can gather something about this archetypal pattern that has to do with setting out on the journey with a simple, naive faith, and that the journey is then supported in surprising ways. In no way am I saying that Jerry Winstrom was a, quote, simpleton or a, quote, fool in the pejorative sense. But he did feel called to go on a quest that required courage and a trust in simplicity and the risk of appearing foolish in the eyes of others. The other archetypal theme that strikes me in Jerry's story has to do with making a great sacrifice. In Jerry's case, the destruction of all his art. I think of Abraham being called to sacrifice his beloved son, Isaac. His hand was stayed at the last moment, but he had to show that he was willing to commit the sacrifice. I also think of Navajo sand paintings as well as Tibetan sand paintings. Hours and days are spent creating ritual works that are spectacularly complex and beautiful, and then those who created these sand paintings must destroy them. These are exercises in our big task, which ultimately is about letting go. We're still doing our GoDaddy promotion. If you're thinking of buying a domain name, transferring a domain, or getting some web hosting, I have some discount codes that can save you some money. Just go to our site at shrinkwrapradio.com and look in the left-hand margin. You'll find a link to 3 different promotional codes that will entitle you to some great discounts. And while you're looking at the left-hand side of the show's page, you'll also find a link to our Frapper map. If you haven't already done so, please put yourself on our Frapper map, which allows you to place a digital pushpin on the location where you live. You can get there from our site at shrinkwrapradio.com or by going directly to www.frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. And remember, Frapper is spelled F-R-A-P-P-R. We now have 107 pens on the map, which is great. And at the same time, some of our recent episodes have had more than 2,000 downloads, which is even greater. So where are the other 1,900 of you? Take a moment and go to our homepage, find the Frapper link, and let us see where you are. It's so thrilling to me each time I discover a new pen on the map. So let me give a shout out to a few of the recent additions. A big hello to Chris in Salt Lake City, Utah, to Mark in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to Andreas in Stockholm, Sweden, to Daniel in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, to Brad in Hobart, Tasmania, to Katie in State College, Pennsylvania, to Emily in Orleans, Vermont, to Gina in Swindon, England, to Brian, who does not say where you are. Please let us know, Brian. To Beth in Erlangen, Bavaria, Germany, to Amanda in Denver, Colorado, Lisa in Doral, Florida, and Justin in Katy, Texas. Or maybe it's Caddy, I don't know. And while I'm sending out big hellos, I want to especially remember Muhammad in Baghdad. Haven't heard from you in a while, but I hope you're still okay. And also to my good friends in Ireland from my recent trip, and especially Paul and Hugh. Speaking of my travels, please let me remind you of my upcoming workshop in Tuscany, Italy. This will be a week-long personal growth workshop that I'll be co-leading with Dr. Ronald Alexander. It will be in a beautiful Tuscan retreat center. Let me read you from our flyer. It's the alchemy of initiation, transition, and transformation. Ignite the fire of your inner passion and focus on cultivating your vitality through creativity. Join Ron and David Van Nuys, PhD, in the breathtaking Tuscany countryside. The magical Ebbio Retreat Center is surrounded by evergreen forests in the heart of an ancient sacred volcano. In this experiential workshop, you will awaken to your patterns of holding on and letting go. Through Gestalt and Ericksonian mind-body healing practices and mindfulness meditation, you will receive individual and group attention as you source from the wellspring of the creative unconscious. You will reemerge with a deeper connection to your creative core essence, a renewed sense of vision and values, and an enhanced sense of spaciousness and freedom. For those of you who are already in Europe, it's an easy trip for you, and September is a great time of year to be there. The dates, in fact, are September 18 to the 24th, and we have room for a total of about 8 to 15 people, and there's still spaces available. You can find a link to the Retreat Center on my About Dr. Dave page at shrinkwrapradio.com. Drop me an email right away if you're interested and would like more information. This is your chance to get an intensive experience of me, Dr. Dave, and Dr. Ron Alexander. If you resonate to the psychological perspective of Shrinkwrap Radio, this is your chance to really bring it into your own personal experience. Okay, it's time to go to the mailbag. Let's look at some highlights from our recent emails. First, we hear from Michael in Illinois, who's a regular listener and correspondent. And Michael writes, "I suspect your trip to Ireland went well since it bore a podcast. I am now several podcasts behind, unfortunately, but will catch up in several weeks or so. I'm in the middle of reading ESP in the Lab by Louisa Rhine. I'd like to report an experience I had yesterday. I entered a Subway sandwich shop in Urbana, Illinois, where I live, and ordered a 6-inch turkey sandwich on honey wheat bread with provolone cheese. A moment later, I thought that I would probably prefer pepper jack cheese, but didn't bother to change my order. I walked off for a moment to take a cup and fill it with soda and returned to the counter and noticed that the high school girl who had taken and was preparing my order had put pepper jack rather than provolone cheese on my sandwich. I mentioned to her that I had asked for provolone, but requested that she leave the pepper jack because I had actually thought about wanting Pepper Jack. For some strange reason, I felt as if she had anticipated my preference and was curious enough to ask her if she had ever had other ESP-like experiences. She said she had them regularly and cited the example that she sometimes finds a lost item at her high school and knows immediately to whom it belongs, although the item bears no name. One might pass this off as coincidence, but it felt anomalous as it occurred. Okay, Michael, thanks for sharing that experience. And it does seem like one of those little ESP events that so often happen in everyday life, and we never know when they're going to happen or not happen. One of the things that I was struck by was that you, in fact, were reading a book on ESP at the time by Louisa Rhine, who I think I mentioned on an earlier show. And I know in the case of dreams, when we're reading about dreams, our dream recall tends to go up. And so I think that may relate to a principle of how the unconscious works. And it might be that when you're reading about ESP, that a little bit more ESP might come into your life. Not that that's the only circumstance in which that could happen, but that's just a little hypothesis on my part. Next, we hear from listener Beth in Erlangen, Germany, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I found your show a few weeks ago by searching for podcasts relating to psychological topics, and I'm really thrilled to have found your show. I'm new to podcasting, and I think it's an excellent way for an exchange of ideas to take place. As an expatriate American in Germany, internet radio and podcasts help me to keep in touch with America and the English language. At the moment, I'm not working, but at home taking care of my three children, aged 4 through 8. I love the luxury of being able to stay at home and tend to my children, but I do miss more academic pursuits. I have an MA in modern history and a diploma, the equivalent of an MA in psychology, from the University of Bamberg. Listening to the interviews has really inspired me to pursue a career in psychotherapy. Here in Germany, becoming a certified psychotherapist is a long and rocky road of training and certification. I've always shied away from the challenge because of the time, full-time for 3 years or part-time for 5 years, and expense involved. I've tried to imagine pursuing something else, but I always return to psychotherapy. You mentioned in one of your shows that the effort involved in doing the shows was a great deal. I just wanted you to know that I appreciate your effort and tell you that the show is an inspiration to me. Keep up the good work, Beth." Hey, Beth, thanks so much for that encouragement. And I want to encourage you in turn to keep up those studies and to indeed move ahead towards getting that degree and certification in psychotherapy, since that's where your heart is taking you. My next email is from Stephen, who writes, "Dr. Dave, hello from Brighton on the south coast of England, and many thanks for your latest podcast. What follows is a collection of ideas that I would like to share with you. They are around the same theme, yet offer distinctly different flavors. The holistic approach to life seems to be the theme that can be found almost everywhere I look. For example, in business, I'm becoming increasingly aware of people who use using phrases such as systems thinking or taking the holistic view. In addition, more and more of my friends seem to be aware of whole body thinking, and of course, the world of science and spirituality seem to be mingling along many different crossover points, including the belief that everyone is connected. I certainly believe this latter point to be true. I'm also wondering about the effect on our holistic consciousness of movies such as What the Bleep Do We Know? And The Secret. In my view, they seem to be gaining ground as vehicles which popularize the notions that we are what we think, something that I guess anyone who's interested in using our minds to determine outcomes might agree with. If you're up for a good, easy reading recommendation, there's a great new book available by Daniel H. Pink called A Whole New Mind. I recommend unreservedly. It too presents a holistic take on the world and includes ideas like we are now living in a conceptual age. One of the concepts that Daniel Pink shares is called high touch, high concept. My take on this is that it is people that are really creating value in the world rather than machines. Let me read that sentence again. I think I can do a better job of it. My take on this is that it is people that are really creating value in the world rather than machines, computers, and other technological devices. This means to me that in order to thrive and live abundant lives, then we need to think and act differently to previous centuries. To quote Stephen Covey, we need to be efficient with things and effective with people. Anyway, a search on Amazon or one of the other online booksellers should reveal enough information on Daniel Pink's book to whet your appetite. Maybe he might take a great interview subject for a future podcast. A good suggestion. I'll give that some thought. Changing tack a little, he writes, you will recognize that there's a well-known expression within and without the NLP community. It is, the words that we consistently select determine our destiny. Imagine what our destiny would look like if we consistently selected love-based words. Getting back to the heading of this email, and he's referring to the fact that I had asked listeners to comment on which opening theme they preferred, the jazz piano that I used to open with and the more recent Beatlesque one. And so Stephen writes, getting back to the heading of this email, my vote is for the Beatlesque theme. Why? Well, as I listen to both pieces of music, I notice the immediate impact of them on my body as well as my mind. In short, your specially commissioned musical introduction to your podcast creates, within me at least, a good feeling, a smile, and an energetic boost. What more could I want from a theme tune? Thank you for your excellent work. Best wishes, Stephen. And in fact, Stephen will be an upcoming guest on the show that you'll be hearing more from before long. It's always the risk you take. You write Dr. Dave, you might end up on the show. You can look at it as a risk or as an opportunity. Next, we hear from Stephanie, who writes, hello, I'm a graduate of the New School University in Manhattan. I earned my BA in psychology in 2004. I've been listening to your show and find it very interesting and informative. It is unfortunate that undergraduate studies don't go as in-depth into psych theories and ideas as you do on your program, and I've found these discussions inspiring. I especially like hearing about psychology in Ireland and Australia, as my husband is Irish, and it's possible I might practice there someday. I'll be going back to school to get my MA in counseling psychology at the University of San Francisco in the fall, and intend on getting my MFT license. MFT, by the way, stands for Marriage Family Therapy. It would be really great to hear more about the grad student experience, expectations, mentors, internship experiences, etc., as well as what to expect in your first years of a career. Thanks. I look forward to hearing from you, Stephanie. Well, Stephanie, I think I have had a couple of grad students on, and I will have some more, but I'm not sure how much one can generalize from program to program. I think that the experiences might be fairly unique between different schools, depending upon what their particular outlook is and so on. But we'll see. Maybe I will have more of those kinds of guests. Next, Brad writes, hi, Dr. Dave. I'm originally from China, but I'm currently studying psychology in Tasmania. Since a few weeks ago, I found your podcast in Google by chance. I've been listening to your program whenever time allows me to, but I guess it will take a few months or so before I could catch all the podcasts I've missed. I totally agree with other listeners' comments that you're a good interviewer. From the way you speak, I can sense that you must have a good attitude toward people and life and everything in general. I'm wondering whether you could share some of your insights into life, and in particular, your attitude toward different kinds of people. Also, I hope there would be some program on Jung's analytical psychology relationship with the I Ching. I guess I must stop here as I have to get down to preparing for the upcoming exams. Keep up the good work. The world is listening. Cheers, Brad. Oh, that's great. I hope the world is listening. I definitely will continue to be talking about Jung's analytical psychology, and perhaps we will work in something about the I Ching. I might look for a good guest who could talk on that topic. I think I have one in mind, as a matter of fact, Brad. Next, we hear from Daniel, who writes, Dr. Dave, I love listening to your podcast. I only discovered it recently, and I am through about half of the episodes. I love the interviews and hearing about how they came to do what they do. I was wondering if you could suggest a book to read that would explain the basics of psychology. I'm a programmer and I love puzzles, and you have really got me interested. I would love to have a basic understanding of what makes people tick. Do you have any suggestions? Thanks, and keep up the good work. Well, I did send to Daniel suggestions of a couple of introduction to psychology textbooks. One would be by Henry Gleitman, and the other is Philip Zimbardo. Either one of those would be really good. Daniel went on in a subsequent email to say that he listens to the podcast while he codes at work and really enjoys it. I can't imagine writing computer code and listening to this kind of content at the same time. You have a better multitasking mind than I do, Daniel. Daniel says, one day if you run out of people to interview, I, as I'm sure the rest of the listeners, would love to hear what you have to say on a variety of topics in like a lecture format. He says, I added myself to the Frapper map. I'm an American living in Melbourne, Australia. Okay, thanks for that email, Daniel. Glad to have you listening while you're coding. Don't know if I'll be giving any lectures, but I do try to get across some of my own ideas in responding to each of my guests in the kind of wrap-up after each interview. Okay, I think I better wrap it up here. We've been running long. As I've said so many times before, your listener email and feedback are the fuel this show runs on. So you can send it to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. My username on Skype is ShrinkPod. I've even got a page on MySpace, and the name there is also ShrinkPod. I haven't done much with the MySpace page for lack of time and knowledge, and I'd love a volunteer if there's somebody who's knowledgeable about MySpace with the time and energy to spiff it up for me. If you're out there, please let me know. We also have a call-in number where you can leave voicemail. Nobody's been using it. I don't know why. But that number is 206-888-2746. Please help spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and colleagues. If you have a podcast or a blog, we'd certainly appreciate a plug there. As a matter of fact, we got a great plug from Julianne on her blog and podcast called hypermobility.com. She has a beautiful voice. I highly recommend her podcast to you. I want to close by once again thanking Jerry Winstrom for his very soulful interview. And in keeping with that theme of soul, we close today's show now with a piece of PodSafe music by Ola Onabule titled Soul Town. And you'll find a link to him on the website. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Town's gone. How you gonna do what has been so undone? Once you were hip, right at the tip, the very essence of cool. Street savvy and fly, stealing your eye. Thought you were no. They talk it down that at the peak of its day, it was nothing, nothing but a plain Jane town. You say Soul Town's the way it's all meant to be, and someday we'll build it all again. When we've had enough of this emptiness, far too much of this loneliness, we'll start afresh. Raise it up and go.
that soul towns past, and all those beautiful people you used to know, well, they ain't so fast. You riding high in infinite skies, just being like what you pull. With one dream in your heart, some faith in that dream, you thought that you'd be changing the world. You say slow down's the prettiest place in you, and someday we'll build it all again. When we've had enough of this emptiness, thought too much of the loneliness, we'll start afresh, raise it up and grow. Well, where you gonna go now that soul town's gone? How you gonna do what's been so everywhere. Rainbow flag and soul town.